This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a look at Amazon's new surveillance device. It's called Ring, and they're working aggressively with law enforcement.
Boy, if you think we're in trouble with the big spy's eye in the sky, well, now they want to put one on your doorbell.
Noted First Amendment attorney Martin Garbus joins us to talk about his new book, North of Havana, the untold story of dirty politics, secret diplomacy, and the trial of the Cuban Five.
Cuban Five case was one of the most significant in terms of the corruption of the law in American history. Marty Garbus came in on the case and wrote this book about it. It's a good book.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. When it comes to e-commerce, the multinational tech company Amazon has laid claim to a huge corner of the market. It may surprise some to learn that it's also in the business of surveillance. Amazon aggressively pursues and cultivates law enforcement partnerships. More than 400 police departments across the nation have already joined forces with the tech giant's so-called smart doorbell program, Ring. Part of Amazon's outreach strategy in gaining new police partners is to play on fears of increasing property crime. Ring doesn't just show you who's at your door. It films and records any movement within the local vicinity. It films and records any movement or interaction in the vicinity and then alerts users' phones. With partnerships between corporations and law enforcement to use new surveillance systems in the public, leaving out community input, there come a host of civil liberty concerns, including racial profiling. Joining us to discuss this growing partnership between a mega company and American law enforcement is Matthew Guerrilla of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Matthew is a policy analyst working on surveillance and privacy at the local, state, and federal level. He is a frequent contributor to the Freedom of Information-centered outlet, Muckrock, and his bylines have appeared in The Washington Post and Motherboard. Matthew, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Matthew, what is Amazon's Ring, and when did we first start hearing about it?
Well, Amazon's Ring is a smart doorbell camera that people install on their front doors, and it pings your phone whenever it senses movement, motion, or whenever somebody rings their doorbell, and you get a little notification on your phone that allows you to peer through your own Ring camera. The company has been around for a few years, but it didn't really start expanding quickly until it was acquired by Amazon in 2018.
Now, in one of the pieces that you've written, you've called Ring's partnership with U.S. law enforcement, quote, a perfect storm of surveillance. Tell us how that is.
Well, the partnership with police is problematic in a number of ways because what it essentially has created is a CCTV network that, while it doesn't belong to the government, doesn't belong to municipalities, it belongs essentially to Amazon, who are doing everything they can to cooperate with police and make it as easy for them to acquire footage from your doorbell camera without a warrant as possible.
And we want to talk about that in a minute. But first, we understand Amazon has an aggressive outreach campaign to police departments, sometimes offering incentives, I understand. Can you explain how the company is marketing this to police?
That's a very good question. It's very aggressive, as you've mentioned. We know that some tactics have included in the past, like going to large international police conferences and hosting parties there where police chiefs will come and they'll leave with free Ring cameras and they'll get free alcohol and you know, dance the night away with representatives of Ring. But the other operation of this is very aggressive marketing. So you've seen in emails back and forth between Ring and police departments through Freedom of Information Act requests and the reporting on this that show that Ring representatives follow up with police departments very diligently, and they offer them things. Like, so for instance, one of the kind of tenets of these Ring partnerships is municipalities will pay a lot of money to Ring. I've seen anywhere between $25,000 and $100,000. And in exchange for that money, Ring can offer cameras to city residents for a subsidized price. So they aggressively market them, they offer them subsidized cameras for a municipality, but they also offer them, you know, surveillance. What they're offering them is a police interface to the Ring system that allows them to request the footage of Ring users incredibly easy with just the tap of a button. And so if you have a Ring doorbell camera on your front door, what it looks like is an email or a notification on your phone saying your local police department requests the footage between this hour and this hour. Would you like to give it to them? And there's no button in order to not give your footage to police. You just have to ignore the message, which kind of gives the illusion, one, that if you don't do it, you're being a bad citizen, which you're absolutely not, and two, that you kind of don't have a choice. So all of these incentives make police departments much more willing to work with Amazon to try to push Ring in their own cities.
Okay, and I think what you've just mentioned about the silent pressure for people to turn over the video is really the crux of what we want to talk about. I want to clarify first, is Ring's so-called law enforcement neighborhood portal map interface, is that related to what you were just saying about getting requests from law enforcement to turn over video?
Mm-hmm, yes. Part of the police's interface with Ring is, you know, there's been a bit of conflicting reporting on this, but from what I understand, whether or not it's created by the police department themselves or handed over to them by Amazon, who, you know, as by virtue of you signing up for Ring, have to give your address and so they can map it, police have, many police departments have maps where they can see where Ring cameras are in their city. And so requesting that camera is as simple as, you know, swiping through a map, seeing the camera that you want to get footage from, and clicking on that camera and requesting the footage. So part of this kind of big network of surveillance is also geographical.
Is the footage stored in the cloud?
Yes. So Amazon has the footage. When you read the terms of service, you'll see that while you have access to that footage, you can share it to your own social networks, which they encourage you to do through the Ring interface, the Ring app. The footage is very clearly owned, maybe not owned, but is controlled by Amazon in the sense that it is stored on their cloud for 6 weeks before it's deleted. And in the terms of service, you can read that they can pretty much do anything they want with that footage. They can use it for promotional materials, which they have done. They can alter it in any way. They can use it for a lot more purposes than just store it for you.
Now, Matt, just let's pose a hypothetical before Michael chimes in here. If a police department wants to monitor a particular individual, what's to prevent them, and they know that person has a Ring, what's to prevent them from going to Amazon and saying, please do not delete the footage of Jane Doe after the 6 week period?
Unless the police department has a warrant, I'm not sure how that would work. But the thing about these Ring partnerships is if police wanted to monitor a specific person with a Ring camera, there are a lot of ways they could get around doing it than just going to Amazon. So one way would be to get a warrant and to go to Amazon for their footage. You know, it's really unclear at this point whether Amazon has to inform you as an owner of a Ring camera whether or not police have come directly to them with a warrant and are bypassing you entirely. Because in many instances, if police could have approached you and asked for footage, and if you say no, they can just get a warrant and go straight to Amazon. And in that case, even though you've refused the police, they end up with your footage anyway, and you might not even know. Oh, and the other way they can do it is just by asking you directly. They can say, listen, you can get a notification. We need your footage for a case. Will you please share it with us? And you could do that, theoretically, unknowing that the case they're working on is an investigation of you yourself.
That's interesting.
So do these people who purchase Ring, what do they think they're getting? And do they have to pay a monthly fee for this?
The Ring cameras themselves cost, you know, between like $150 or $250 or something. And I think there is a monthly fee associated with it, but not everyone has to pay it. I'm not sure how the economics of it work out. I mean, we know that how they make their money on Ring is by selling as many cameras as possible. But what people think they're getting is peace of mind. People, you know, even though research, you know, shows that crime rates are down in most parts of the country, that fear of crime is on the rise. And so while people think they're getting peace of mind, they're installing a security camera on their front door, what they're actually kind of getting is the opposite, because every time, you know, a delivery man comes to your front door, every time a dog walker walks by, you get a notification on your phone because there's motion at your house. Suddenly it seems like your house is under siege. So what people really think they're getting is peace of mind, is a little bit of security for their front stoop, but in actuality they're getting a lot of paranoia. And what they're not thinking about is how all of these cameras are networked together. You're not just watching your own porch, you're helping police and Amazon watch every porch in your neighborhood.
So do guests or delivery people or others know that they're being recorded?
That's a good question. I mean, some people, I think, have little signs like people would with traditional security systems saying this home is watched, you know, is you're on security camera. But until Rings become more ubiquitous and people recognize them as security cameras, it's a question of whether or not a person approaching a porch knows they're being filmed. And this raises a lot of, you know, troubling questions for not just for privacy in your neighborhood, but for things like democracy in general. I mean, I don't know how willing some people would be to go door-to-door canvassing for the political candidate of their choice if they know that interaction is being recorded and could be shared to Facebook with a click of a button.
Matt, you mentioned Freedom of Information Act request earlier, and I wondered if it's true that local governments or police have to run any public comments that they might want to make about Ring by Amazon for approval first. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, this is offered as kind of a perk of the partnership, is that you have Amazon and Ring's communications experts. They're at your disposal, not just for helping you field questions about the partnership or helping you, you know, in some places push the adoption of Ring in certain neighborhoods, but also to help you as a police department get footage from people. So there's some of their Q&As, some of their resources they have for police departments is helping you best pitch why a certain resident should share their Ring footage with you. But the other side of this relationship is that Ring is really strict about the messaging that goes out to the public about Ring from police departments. And so through some of these, you know, released emails, we've seen Ring actually ask police departments to change press releases that are already out because they don't like some of the certain wording. Or as one article that got a lot of attention a few weeks ago reported, Ring doesn't like police departments to use the word surveillance when they talk about what these cameras are and what this network is.
That's fascinating and really troubling to me.
Yeah, this is really a 1984 scenario, Matt. Why should communities care about Ring coming to their neighborhoods? What's at risk here? I think it's more than what you've already said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things at risk. I mean, apart from just the fact that, you know, a lot of people don't necessarily want to live in a society where they're constantly being, you know, captured on footage that they have no control over and that the camera owner or Amazon or police have access to that footage all the time. The other aspect is, like I said, paranoia. A lot of people are suddenly frightened that their neighborhoods are much more dangerous than they actually are because they're constantly getting notifications that there's a person in the bushes in front of their house when really, who knows, it's somebody delivering a newspaper that went awry. And the other problem with this is it really ends up threatening vulnerable communities in a way that surveillance often does. For instance, I mean, I think I've called it somewhere that Amazon Ring is in some ways a digital superhighway for racial profiling, in the sense that if every person you see walk by your Ring camera is a potential criminal, then a lot of people's, you know, implicit or very real biases about what type of person looks suspicious come to the surface. And it'd be one thing if you could just, if you're just, you know, looking at your own security camera and saying that person looks suspicious, but when you can suddenly share that footage with police, when you can share that footage with everybody in your neighborhood who's on the neighbor's app, suddenly racial profiling gets outsized and can be exported very, very quickly and have real-world consequences.
Matt, are you able to relay the story of the African-American real estate agent who was stopped by police?
Yeah, I mean, this is a story, I don't remember the explicit details, but it was something like an African-American real estate, you know, doing what real estate agents often do, which is walking through a neighborhood and, you know, looking at houses, appraising them, seeing what's on the market, and somebody who had been, you know, in their house had seen this, and through their eyes, because these apps have conditioned us to see everybody on the street as a potential criminal, and through, you know, obvious racial bias, opened up their app that they communicate with their neighborhood on, and specifically about public safety and crime, and reported what they saw as suspicious, as what looked to be casing a house for later burglary. The cops were eventually called. And this can have the, you know, put people in danger who have done absolutely nothing wrong other than taking a stroll through a neighborhood.
We're speaking with Matthew Garaglia of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Matthew, has there been any lawsuits regarding Ring brought yet or contemplated?
Not yet, but we're beginning to see a real public pushback against not just Ring, but the type of surveillance that Ring brings into neighborhoods. So with the rise of city ordinances banning facial recognition use by police and governments, for instance, I think we're going to start to see a lot more community backlash to these types of partnerships. But part of the thing that's so nefarious about Ring is that when you buy a Ring to put on your front door to keep your house safe, it's very hard to conceptualize it as part of a large kind of state-accessible surveillance network. And so as people begin to realize that their domestic decisions have big national and at least community-wide implications, I'm hoping we're going to start to see some pushback.
Matt, I'm curious about how Amazon profits from the Ring, and I have an idea that I want to run by you. We know that Amazon and all the other large data aggregators resell demographic information to marketers. I am suspecting that Ring represents a foothold for Amazon to get into law enforcement to possibly start the beginning of a codependent relationship, whereas policing may become more data-driven or technology-driven, like with things like ShotSpotter and equipment like that, that Amazon wants to become a long-term partner for new products like this initial surveillance system. Do you have thoughts about that?
There's no doubt that there's a lot of money to be made by getting into law enforcement and, by extension, kind of military and counterinsurgency and all of those kind of contracts that have, you know, billions and billions and billions of dollars at their disposal. And there's no doubt that those types of government agencies are going to be absolutely just scooping up as much kind of face recognition software as they can, cloud storage, things that can, you know, streamline their data analysis. So there's no doubt that that is a big market that Amazon is looking toward. But I think what Amazon is also looking to do is get their foothold in the kind of smart home, smart appliance world in a way that will eventually bring together all of your Amazon products. So not just will your Alexa be linked to your doorbell, but your phone can tell you when the face recognition software on your Ring has detected that your uncle has come over, and then, you know, you can use that to unlock your Amazon smart door or whatever. So I think part of it is about the future of law enforcement and government contracts. But I think also a big part of it is integrating security and surveillance into the larger strategy for an Amazon smart home.
Yeah, it's really creepy. Last month I went to my cardiologist. I live in Brooklyn, and the doctor's in Manhattan. So when I got through with the doctor, I had to drive through the tunnel that goes from Manhattan to Brooklyn, and they take your photograph when you enter the tunnel. So they knew about what my doctor had to say before I even got home. This kind of thing is all interconnected and plenty spooky.
Yeah, I would be really wary in the future of any moves. And we know they have a patent for this. As far as we know, it's not integrated in the U.S. yet. But I would be really wary if Amazon starts making moves to put facial recognition on your Ring cameras, because there are so many hypothetical scenarios. Like, what happens if your, you know, pizza delivery person has a criminal record, and because they've stepped on your porch, every time they step on a porch with a Ring, police get called just because of their record, even though they're there to do their job. You know, it's going to complicate a lot of people's lives once face recognition gets involved on everybody's front stoop.
The other concern, of course, is with the proliferation of security technology in so-called smart homes, the possibility of being hacked and having all that data not properly protected by Amazon.
Oh, absolutely. Anytime in these days, anytime you have somebody, an entity, collecting massive amounts of very personal data, you have to believe that data has a bit of a target on it. And you have to wonder how comfortable you'd be with that data getting hacked and getting released out into the world.
Matthew, we're coming to an end of our allotted time, but I wanted to ask you how our listeners can learn more about your work and the work of the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Yeah, so the Electronic Frontier Foundation is one of the premier civil liberties organizations in the United States and internationally focused on freedom in the digital world. Specifically, my work revolves around surveillance and privacy involving all things digital and online. So anybody who is interested in the work, and interested in staying attuned to what's happening with Ring and with face recognition, can go to EFF.org. They can follow our work. They can become a member of the Electronic Frontier Foundation and support the work that we're doing here.
We love EFF, Matthew. A final question. How did you become interested in this area?
That's a good question, yeah. I started filing FOIA requests very early on in my college experience, just as a curiosity. I was interested in, you know, the FBI files, the surveillance files of kind of, you know, famous 20th century figures. And as I dove deeper and deeper into the history of surveillance, I began to realize that, you know, with more technology in our lives, surveillance has just gotten more and more prevalent and more ubiquitous. And so ever since then, I've been really engaged in this and fighting the good fight.
Well, Matthew, it's been really thrilling to have you on. Eerily so, we must say. And we hope to stay in touch to have you on about other surveillance and civil liberties issues.
And don't worry if you come to my doorstep.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much. Anytime.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
North of Havana, the untold story of dirty politics, secret diplomacy, and the trial of the Cuban Five is the recent publication by our guest attorney Martin Garbus. This case was one of the most significant ones in recent times. Attorney Len Wineglass had originally taken the case to appeal the matter for the already convicted Cuban Five. The appeal was ultimately lost. Wineglass died, and his dear friend, our guest Martin Garbus, stepped in to what looked like a lost cause. Four of the five men were in prison, serving long sentences. Cuba had been an American colony up until 1959, when the widely popular Cuban Revolution succeeded in getting the country's independence from the USA. To reverse this has been American policy ever since. The Helms-Burton Act made counter-revolution by the American government a government policy written into American law. Martin Garber started representing Cuban Five member Gerardo Hernandez, who at the time had been found guilty of conspiracy to commit espionage against the United States sometime in the future, as well as murder. Hernandez and his four comrades had been sent from Cuba to Miami by the government of Cuba to spy not on the United States, but on the counter-revolutionary Cubans in Miami who were launching terrorist activities from Florida directed at persons and property in Cuba, attempting to sabotage the Cuban economy, which was in bad shape when a new Russian government cut them off. The Cubans gathered information on the Miami-based terrorists, compiling a lengthy dossier on their murderous activities, and turned it over to the FBI. They asked the U.S. government to stop the terrorists, who were targeting the Cuban tourist industry by planting bombs at the Havana airport, on buses, and in a hotel, killing an Italian vacationer. But instead of stopping the terrorists, the U.S. government used the dossier to figure out the identities of the Cuban Five. They were arrested, prosecuted, convicted, and sentenced to long prison terms. While the Cubans were in Miami, a group of counter-revolutionary Cubans in that city, calling themselves Brothers to the Rescue, were provocatively flying small planes over Havana, dropping anti-Castro leaflets. They were warned by the Cuban government that if they persisted, the planes would be shot down. They persisted. The planes were shot down. Hernandez was convicted of murder, although he had no prior knowledge about the shootdown. Martin Garbus is one of our great trial lawyers. He has appeared before the United States Supreme Court on leading First Amendment and constitutional law cases. He lives in New York City and joins us in our studio.
Martin Garbus, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi. It's lovely to see you.
You came to the Cuban Five case after their attorney, your dear friend Len Wineglass, had died 7 years ago. It was Len's last major case. And when he was retained, the five had already been convicted. Why did you take on what was essentially a lost cause? And can you talk about your experience in the Army when you enlisted at age 21?
Well, with respect to the case, Lenny and I had been talking about it ever since he got involved in the case. And then after he was involved, there was this article in the Miami Herald which indicated that a lot of the people who had been covering the case and a lot of the media had received monies from the American government in a variety of ways. First of all, through something called Radio Marti, and then through out-and-out payments. And it was very clear to me that these were new issues that had not yet surfaced. Lenny and I had talked about it. We had originally talked about my taking the case up on the petition for cert. Ultimately, Tom Goldstein did it. And then after Lenny died, I met with Ricardo Alarcon and some of the others, and I agreed to do it. Lenny and I had a long history, and the amount of time that we spent on the case for the 6 or 7 years prior to the time I got in was, for me, very, very rich. It was a personal experience. Lenny and I had been co-counsel in the Kathy Boudin case in 1981, and he and I worked together for 3 years in a court, in a number of courts, the Southern District, Rockland County, Orange County on that case. And we developed over the years this very, very close, respectful relationship. I met Lenny again in the Dan Ellsberg case. I was an could have been an unindicted co-conspirator in that case. I ultimately was not. Lenny represented Russo, and Leonard Boudin represented Dan. So we were kind of a small crowd with respect to that case. But Lenny and I first met back in the early 60s when you had the Newark, a lot of criminal cases coming out of either the Newark Rebellion, the Newark riots, whatever you call it. So Lenny and I had been together for a great deal of our professional lives, personally and professionally. I was always skeptical when Lenny and I spoke about the case that there ever could be a break in the case because the case was so difficult. In the Army, one of the things you asked about, in the Army I had been court-martialed. I had gone into the Army in, I think, 1957-58, and they sent me to some place called the Information and Education Center. And after basic training, they were trying to train us, allegedly, so that we could speak and we could read the New York Times to the troops overseas. Korea had ended. And we were asked to give a number of speeches. First speech I gave, I think, was we should recognize Red China. This was at a time when that was not the American policy. It was shortly after McCarthy had purged a great many people from the American government because of their leanings towards Red China. And the Army man in charge of my class after that said that he thought what I was saying was inappropriate because it was not Army policy. I listened to him, and I then had to make another speech. And the other speech I thought was far less controversial, and that had to do with Sacco Vanzetti and claiming that that was an unjust arrest and that the politics of the time what led to their conviction. He said, you shouldn't do that. If you do that again, you're going to get into trouble. So then I picked something which I thought was totally safe. It was a subject about a book written by Irwin Griswold, who was then at Harvard, and it talked about the sanctity of the Fifth Amendment and the right of people to take the Fifth Amendment before House committees. I was naive in a way, and I hadn't realized things that I thought were basic and accepted would be that hostily treated. In any event, as a result, I was court-martialed. The Army decided not to give me a dishonorable discharge, in large part because they didn't want me to get the benefit of getting out of the Army after 4 or 5 months. So they kept me there for a while. A deal was cut. I was stripped of my security clearance, and they stuck me at a variety of Army bases. One of the blessings of all that was I was able to go to law school at night. The Army, for a period of time, paid for my room and board. I would have been financially unable to go otherwise. I never had that particular aspiration because it was really totally out of my economic reach. And then as the years went on, I got involved in civil contempts and all that kind of stuff. And then did a number of other cases.
Did them and did them well, Marty.
Thank you.
We're speaking with Marty Garbus. Marty, you started representing the Cuban, quote, spy, Gerardo Hernandez. I met him in Cuba. It was quite an experience.
You met him subsequently?
Yeah, when he got out, and I was in Havana. I was wondering what it was like for you when you first met him. Tell us about that experience and what he was like.
Well, Gerardo was incredible. All these guys were incredible. They were incredible because very few people were treated as badly as they were in the criminal system. And they had no backup and no support. There was not any governmental agency. There was not any legal aid operation. There was no sympathy for Cuban spies who had allegedly killed three Americans. And given the narrowness of the prison system, many of the prison guards, maybe the prisoners, many of the prisoners thought if you had something like Iraq, if you had something like 9/11, that somehow the Cubans were involved in it, not unlike John Bolton, who seems to see them as the devils wherever he looked. And of course, Trump, who sees them as the devil. I thought that the amazing thing about the Cuban Five, an amazing thing about the Cuban Five, oh, by the way, there's a movie on them coming out. It's called The Wasp Network, and it's going to be shown at the New York Film Festival October 5th. It opened in Venice 10 days ago, and it's about the Cuban Five while they're underground. The film ends as they are arrested, and then there's something at the end that tells you what happened to them. But it's a look at Gerardo and the other people, Rene Gonzalez, about them going to Miami under an understanding with the government, our government, in an attempt to infiltrate the Cuban right wing. Now, Gerardo in prison was extraordinary. You walked in and he was dressed as they all are in jumpsuits and then those shoes. It's as if he were in a tuxedo. He had a sense of himself. He had a sense of dignity. He had an awareness. My book talks about what they did to him. 17 months in solitary. You know, we've gotten used to the idea now of solitary, and we know it's offensive, and we think solitary is just putting a guy alone in a cell. That's not what it is at all. What they did with Gerardo, or what they've done with other people, is he would go into a cell, they would chain him to the bottom bunk of his cell, and he would lie there for a month. He would lie there in his own feces, urine, occasionally. Once when he went into solitary, for about 2 months, they put guys on the side of him, on each side. It was three cells down below. And these guys yelled, they were upset, mentally upset. They screamed and yelled 24 hours a day. And he heard them. And it was clearly an attempt to drive him crazy. None of these guys ever had said anything wrong, never had any disciplinary action taken against them. As we're talking now, I forget the word. And that's remarkable. I've known guys in jail who pick that up all the time, no matter how much they try. Leonard Peltier tried for all the time he was in jail to avoid it. They slapped it all over him. Cuban Five, their conduct in jail was absolutely extraordinary. And then one of the wonderful stories is that as we went into, I guess, 2013, Senator Leahy came in. He met Adriana. He was very moved by her. Leahy knew of Gerardo, was very moved by him, and they did something that was remarkable. What they arranged was Adriana and Gerardo had met and married when they were both very young, and over the 16 years that he was in prison, the government took the position that she could not visit him. Again, that's something that they had control over. Most other prisoners can get visitors, but they decided that Gerardo could not get any visits from his wife. They had a list that said you can only get visitors from people you knew beforehand. Now, he'd been underground for X number of years, and then he'd been imprisoned for X number of years. So that meant that the number of people who knew him 20, 25 years ago in the United States was very close to zero. So they really gave it to him as much as they could. Ultimately, through Senator Leahy, one day, Gerardo was removed from the prison. He was sent down to Los Angeles. He then gave his semen, and ultimately his wife was impregnated while he was in jail. Nobody knew about it. Had Menendez ever heard about it? Had Rubio ever heard about it? They would have went through the roof. So it's an extraordinary credit to Leahy, Obama, Ben Rhodes, and this was how the negotiation gradually went. And then there was a guy who I talk about in the book, Alan Gross, the best thing that ever happened to the Cuban Five, an American spy arrested in Cuba. America denied it. There was a trial. He was convicted, sentenced to 15 years. And then they started more or less the negotiations between Gerardo and between Cuba and the United States. And part of that led to the rapprochement in December 2014. America refused to call it a spy swap or anything like that, but the remaining Cubans, three then, went back to Cuba. Alan Gross and someone else, a longtime prisoner, came up here, and I have seen Gerardo since then. You've seen Gerardo since then, Michael. I mean, he's extraordinary. Whether or not what role he ultimately plays in the Cuban government, I certainly don't know, but he's a figure of enormous respect, as is Rene Gonzalez, who worked with Gerardo. The whole idea that Gerardo was charged with conspiracy to murder the three men who were shot down in 1996. The idea that Gerardo, given his role and status, would have the authority to shoot down three American planes, or two American planes that were, and kill four people, is totally preposterous. One of the interesting things is Castro, in 1994, when Clinton was in, there looked like there could be some kind of rapprochement then. Clinton wanted to loosen the embargo and wanted to, in order to get the Democratic vote from the Cubans, wanted really to lean over to try and get the young, new Cuban votes. You had the Elian Gonzalez situation, where ultimately Clinton returns this young boy to Cuba. So you had what appeared to be a period of rapprochement. Then you have the shootdown. In 2000, when Fidel was talking to certain people from the United States, I'm not at liberty to say who it was, he said, Herodotus said, Greek philosopher, historian, that every general, well, first of all, he said that all politics, says Castro, all law is determined by two elements, fear and greed. And then he said that Herodotus said that every general makes one great mistake in his lifetime. And Castro said, my mistake was ordering the shoot down. Now, at the time, back in 96, when all this was going on, Rubio wanted to indict Castro, the conservative Florida congresswoman, and other people wanted to indict Castro and pin it on him. They couldn't do that, so they pinned it on the Cuban Five.
We're speaking with attorney Martin Garbus, the author of North of Havana, The Untold Story of Dirty Politics, Secret Diplomacy, and the Trial of the Cuban Five. Extremely significant legal case. Marty writes beautifully about it, North of Havana. Marty, there are three aspects of the case that we want to talk to you about. The first is the charge of conspiracy. Why do you think this charge was used against the Cuban Five? Do you think prosecutors like it because they don't have to prove an underlying commission of a crime?
I think so, and I think what's directly related to what you said is there was a prosecutor at the time of the shootdown. He refused to prosecute. Another prosecutor comes in. He refuses to prosecute. Then you have a Reagan appointee during the Bush-Gore election. He prosecutes. So the prosecution starts in May of 1999, the Bush against Gore election is resolved, basically, and goes on a year later. So during the entire election, you have the claim that, you know, Clinton was leaning over too far to the Cubans, three Americans were killed, and also the fact that he set back Elian Gonzalez after the election in Miami, when Florida helped or was indispensable to Bush coming in. There were signs hung from the highways saying they had the names of the four people who were killed, and they were saying, "We avenged you." And there were signs also saying, with respect to Gonzalez, who had been sent back, that "We avenged you by voting for Bush." So I think the question that you're asking, namely, when you look at this book, when you look at the incident, you have to look at the facts of the case as a legal issue. Then you look at the time and the setting and the political gain that was involved. And then you have to take a third step and see what is today and what are the consequences of that and what are the effects of that and how does that affect today's presidential election, or pardon me, next year's presidential election, and how has it affected the politics. Back in 68, Rubio said that there was proof that Trump had invested $68,000 in Cuba, violating the boycott. And he, at the time that he was running against Trump, asked for an examination into that. The examination never came. The issue has long since been dropped. Given what we know about Trump, there's hardly any doubt that he did try and make investments, and he violated the embargo.
Marty, the second aspect that we wanted to mention was keeping the venue in Miami, which, as everyone knows, is a hotbed for Cuban counter-revolutionary activity. That was obviously highly prejudicial. How did they get away with that? You wrote that it was unthinkable there was no change of venue, but did anything happen?
What happened was that the lawyers who represented the defendants were people who were not used to political struggles. They were being branded as communists. And in fact, during the trial, Basulto, when being examined by Gerardo's then lawyer, McKenna, said, "I don't have to answer any questions from a communist agent," meaning Basulto. I think what happened is, in order to be, let's say, polite, after the jury was selected, one of the lawyers said, "Thank you, we have a fair jury now." Language roughly like that. Yeah. That was murder.
Yeah.
That you could never get away from that sentence, and it was there throughout, and it was just lawyers being over-solicitous, over-obsequious, but given what these non-political lawyers were faced with, one of them, who was himself a Cuban, Joaquin Menendez, had to move out of his house. There were bomb threats against him. I didn't discuss that very much in the book. I think I probably should have. The pressures brought on all the defense lawyers was very, very high. They didn't want to go down in flames over what was a legal aid assignment. Now, why Cuba didn't supply the defendants with lawyers, why Cuba didn't acknowledge that these were Cuban representatives is a part of the story that's discussed in the book. But they didn't. It wasn't until after the conviction that there was really an acknowledgement of what they were doing.
Marty, at the outset of the show, you spoke about the what could be construed as new evidence, the revelations that journalists in Miami were paid by the American government to slant their coverage, which they did, and influence the jury pool, which they did. Whatever happened with that?
We filed endless papers before Judge Leonard, who had been the judge who had sat on the conviction. We spent over 4 years filing pieces of paper. We did extraordinary research to the extent that we could. We really had to get more information. We had a lot of information, but not enough. And we made motion after motion. Judge Leonard, we started making the motions, I think, in about 2011. By 2014, she had never decided one single motion. It was the longest unresolved habeas corpus in the Fifth Circuit. What the media could do, you know, we hear the word fake news. You know, all of a sudden we hear words like fake news. We forget what the media did a lot back then. You know, all of a sudden the FBI and the CIA are paragons of virtue. But what the media did at that point is, for example, they followed the defense lawyers out to their cars so that people could see who the defense lawyers were. They followed the jurors out to their cars with the license plates so the community could learn who the jurors were. She didn't sequester them. It was 7 months. So that the pressures brought to bear on all the participants in the case. The judge, inexperienced, decent, tried to keep some control over that. It was beyond her capabilities. We've all looked at cases, Scottsboro and the Oklahoma case, and O.J. Simpson. We've seen all this stuff. What went on here was very, very different. It was remarkable in the amount. And also that the newspapers were supposed to be kept out of the jury room. The jurors saw the newspapers. And as you know, when you try and set aside a conviction, as we did, we try to speak to some of the jurors. The jurors, by the way, a seven-month trial, they sat, deliberations were allegedly 14 hours over a space of 5 days. They sat 2 hours, 4 hours, 3 hours. There's no question but they had their minds made up the first minute. In an attempt to give a sense of decency to the proceedings, they sat for 15 hours before they came back with a verdict. As you also know, it's very, very hard, and certainly in that political environment, to set aside a jury verdict. And you have to show all kinds of direct influence of this media, et cetera, et cetera. We did whatever we could. We tried to get discovery. We never got. We filed motion after motion after motion to discovery. She refused to decide it. We made applications to the 11th Circuit then to get her to decide things. She wouldn't do it. This case was the jewel, if you will, in her reputation. And she was not about to allow it to be set aside.
Marty, could you talk about how the law was corrupted in this case? You call the trial a show trial. And that's what I'm afraid is going to happen to Julian Assange if they ever get him back here. What's a show trial?
A show trial, it seems to me, is a trial that is used to make a political statement. And here the government, after three prosecutors turned it down, a fourth prosecutor brings the trial, and they try to use it to show the guilt. They stretch the evidence in a certain way. They deny the defense certain information. I mean, we're used to using the word show trials when we, in past terminology, Moscow, or we used to talk about the show trials in the Soviet Union. You have show trials here as well. And clearly, however one feels about Assange and however one feels about the validity of what he did, if he comes here, it'll be a brutal attack on the media. It'll be a brutal attack on people who try and give information. Dan Ellsberg, because he had certain credentials, as well as very respected lawyers, was never pilloried in the way that Assange will be pilloried, and also there were different times and probably different judges.
Marty, we're running out of time. Unfortunately, we could listen to you for hours, but we'd like to ask you, what advice would you give to young lawyers and those thinking about entering the profession?
I think a very interesting moral question, and this is what I'm writing about in my new book, is the whole question of truth, honesty, and justice. And I think that when you go to court, there is often a contradiction between truth, honesty, and justice. And ultimately, every lawyer who gets involved in cases like this is faced with how you balance those values. The way I balance the value is in favor of justice. Now, I think that's a complicated issue for many people. I had an old friend, Charles Gary, and we used to talk about that at great length. Also, my first legal experience, I worked for several years, a lawyer named Emil Zola Berman. His brother was named Alfred Dreyfus Berman, and, you know, from socialists in New York. And so I worked for him at night after I got out of the Army. So I had 2 years in court before I graduated law school. And I was a court rat. I mean, that was the nature of the work I was doing. I was carrying his bag for 2 years. I carried his bag, let's say, from September to June. He was never in an office. He just went from case to case to case. So I really saw what the law was about. I saw a judge who became very respected, became the chief judge of the Court of Appeals, and I saw facts change. I saw buses move hundreds of feet. I saw police when I was long before I graduated law school. I saw police change testimony. So by the time I finished law school, I had 2 years in seeing the way the law worked, the lawless world of the law.
Before we let you go, Martin Garbus, tell us how our listeners can follow your work.
Well, right now I'm involved representing, we have disciplinary proceedings starting Monday against a lawyer named Stephen Donziger. Stephen Donziger got a $12 billion judgment out of Ecuador against Chevron for environmental destruction. When he tried to enforce the judgment ultimately, which was went through the entire Ecuadorian system, he came into New York. He went before Judge Kaplan. Judge Kaplan said that the verdict was procured by fraud, and he then charged Steve Donziger with civil and criminal contempt and made a reference to the Bar Association. We are starting a proceeding on Monday with respect to Steve's disciplinary proceeding. There are criminal proceedings against him also because he refused to turn over, amongst other things, his computer files, which had documents between he and his clients. That's what I'm doing right now. And I'd also spend some time in January and February in Texas representing migrants. And as soon as this is over, I'll go back there.
That's quite a plateful.
Yeah, really, really.
Thank you.
Martin Garbus, you've written an excellent book. I urge our listeners to get a copy of it. It's called North of Havana, The Untold Story of Dirty Politics, Secret Diplomacy, and the Trial of the Cuban Five. It was put out by the New Press, an excellent publishing house.
Yes, it is.
We congratulate you for your good work on this book and
your
good work, generally speaking,
Thank
Marty.
Thank you, Marty. Thank you.
Pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.